Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Rama Rama.
Rama Rama.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Welcome everyone for the mentorship meeting and class. Luckily today we have the fortune of having His Holiness Jayadvaita Swami. So, in traditional Pandavasana way, which he's had a lot of today actually, because we had the AGM, and I think we got a bit carried away, but yes, in our traditional Pandavasana way, let's please welcome Maharaj with three loud Hari Bols.
Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol!
So, we're very much looking forward today for the class. The topic has been set as, how can we guide each other through spiritual life? That means as friends, how can our seniors guide us, and how can we also guide our juniors? So we want, basically, topics come about because we can come together and have a good time and have fun, but we also here for a greater purpose, for the higher principle, to serve Srila Prabhupada and serve the Lord. So without further ado, I pass it over to Maharaj, and yeah. Let's enjoy. Hare Bol.
I thought we were going to guide one another. Now I hear we're going to enjoy. Om Gana Timirantasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Nobistam Stapitam yena bhutale svayam rupa kadamayam tadati shapadantikam bandeham shri guru shri jatapadakamadam shri gurum vaishnavamsa shri rupam shagrajatam shahagana raganatam vitam stam sajivam Shadvaitam, Shavadhutam, Purjana Sahitam, Krishna Chaitanya Devam, Sri Radha, Krishna Paran, Shahagana Lalita, Sri Vishakam Vitamsta. He Krishna, Karana Sindho, Dina Bandho Jagatpate, Gopesha Gopika Kanta, Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kamshana Gaurangi Raje Vrindavaneshadi Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kopatilu Vyascha Kripa Sindho Vyayevasha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adhita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 In the Bhagavad Gita, Machchita Madgata Prana Bodhiyanta Paraspara Katayantas Chamam Nityam Tushanticha Ramanticha. Srila Prabhupada says this is the engagement of the great souls. Great souls means devotees. The great souls are always thinking of Krishna, Machchita. And Madgata Prana, they've dedicated their lives to Krishna. And Bodhiyanta Parasparam. Paraspara means mutually. And Bodhiyanta, enlightening one another. Enlightening one another about Krishna. Katiyantas Chamam Nityam. Always talking about Krishna. Tushanticha Ramanticha. In this way, they're getting great pleasure and satisfaction. This is actually association of devotees. So, Bodhianta Parasparam, to enlighten one, and Prabhupada compared this to the business of scientists. Scientists are busy in their research laboratories, they're pursuing their research agendas and making discoveries. And then they come together in scientific conferences and they talk about their discoveries. They enlighten one another. This, I found this, and it appears to me this, and this is showing this characteristic and that characteristic, and when this is together with this, this happens. And the other one says, well, I don't know, because my experience is this, 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 this. So they get excited, actually. They start talking about their discoveries and the possibilities and other kinds of research they could do, and they talk about all sorts of things. This is how they get their inspiration and enlightenment, by talking with one another about their topics. So devotees also do that. They're interested in the science of Krishna, they're pursuing the science of Krishna, and then they get together and they share their discoveries, or they compare notes, they talk about what to do next. Dushyanti charamanti cha. In this way they feel transcendental pleasure. So the first assumption is that we're actually doing something in Krishna consciousness, because it's hard to enlighten one another if we don't have anything to say. If we're reading Prabhupada's books, for example, there's so much to say. Even if you read a little something, I know devotees, just as a practice, they make it their business to say something that they read in a book to somebody. They'll meet somebody and say something like, Hari Bol Prabhu, you know, for one who's controlled the mind is the best friend. And for one who controls the doesn't control the mind's the worst enemy. How are things going? You know, they just make it their business to read something and repeat it. And by repeating it, it becomes stronger, and they enjoy. Now that's very formal, formulaic sort of, I read something and at least four devotees that I meet today, I'll say this verse. But there's some content there. They have something to say about Krishna. And the more we read these books or hear from devotees about Krishna, then the more we have to think about, first of all, and the more we have to say. Or the more we may have questions that, you know, I heard this and that, but I don't get it. What do you think? Or what does it mean? Or what do you suppose it means? Or how are we supposed to apply it? Or did Prabhupada say anything else about this? Or, yeah. You've got a subject matter. If you're two students studying physics, when you get together, you say, you know, what? Did you get this? No, I couldn't figure it out. You know, does anybody understand this? Yeah, I think it means this, 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 this. But if you haven't read the book, they haven't read the book, you know, it's like, well, how's it going? I don't know, the professor's a jerk. So the first assumption is that we have something to say about Krishna because we're hearing about Krishna, we're reading about Krishna, we have an interest in Krishna, and both parties are doing the same thing, so we get together, and then it creates more Krishna katha. Prabhupada one time was asked, he was walking down one of those corridors in an airport, and there was some reporter, journalist, sort of chasing him, trying to keep up with him. Sir, what will be the result of this chanting? Prabhupada said, chanting? Chanting. The result of the chanting will be more chanting. The result of the chanting will be more chanting. The volume just went up or something there because we're starting to get a little feedback. It's a little too, I think it's above what we need. Hare Krishna, you can hear in the back? Okay, so we're all right. So the result, we're reading, we're chanting, then the result when we get together is there'll be more reading, there'll be more chanting, there'll be more discussion about Krishna. So that it becomes more blissful. The tushanti cha ramanti cha, the devotees enjoy getting together and talking about Krishna. This is what they do in the spiritual sky, by the way. They get together and they talk about Krishna. You read, there's a section, the gopis are churning butter. Yashoda Mayi and the gopis, they're all churning butter. And while they're churning butter, they're all chanting about the glories of Krishna. They're singing something about Krishna, they're talking something about Krishna. Well, that's what you do in the spiritual sky. And they're enjoying. It's not like, oh, we've got to talk about Krishna another hour and a half. It's so wonderful that they, and they have different ways of doing it. They get together in the house of Yashoda Mayi, all the other ladies get together, and they start complaining about Krishna. He does this, he does that, he invades our houses, and he trespasses, and he pinches the babies, and he gets, and he does all these, he's a mischief monger, and he's, now he's, he's pretending to be an innocent little boy, but actually, and they're getting together, and it seems like they're lodging complaints, but actually what it is they're getting together and enjoying talking about Krishna. And they're especially enjoying because they're doing it in Krishna's presence. There's a special taste in complaining about Krishna while he's there. So they do that. They're talking about Krishna, or the boys come home. Mother, Krishna killed such a demon today? Really? What? Talking about Krishna. This is transcendental gossip. In the material world, there are full publications that are just full of gossip. So the spiritual world is also full of gossip, but it's all about Krishna. And there are so many rumors and things about Krishna. It's very nice. So one thing about getting together is that if we're all cultivating something individually, then when we get together, we have something to talk about. And the next thing is service. Because my experience is that you get intimacy among devotees when you're serving together. I don't have many friends that I have as devotee friends just because we're friends. I have so many devotee friends who are friends because we served together. Because we were in some place and working on something or something or something or something. So that's when you really get to know people and get to form a relationship with them, when you're serving together. Even in the material world, it's like that. Army buddies, the people who served in the war together. They came. One guy came from way out over there, another guy came from way out over here. Two people who never would have had anything to do with one another. They're different kinds of people, maybe different intellectual or social levels or something. Oh yeah, we have the we didn't do a mobile check. Mobile check. So they're war buddies. Why? Because they served together. They were both in a tight spot, being attacked by whoever it was, or one guy saved the other guy, or one guy lied to the superior officers and other in order to help the other guy out or something. They serve together. When we serve together, then these relationships develop. I do something for you, you do something for me, or we both do something together, we both get inspiration, we talk about how should we do this, how should we do that, whatever it might be, if it's raising funds, or it's laying out a book, designing a book, or it's in my case it's designing and proofreading and typesetting and editing and all of that kind of stuff. But it could be anything for Krishna Sankirtan. Devotees who go out, go out to this place or that place together, and they were day after day. Such a relationship, years and decades later. So when we serve Krishna together, then also you're talking about Krishna Katha, how to serve Krishna. Should we do this? Should we do that? And then Krishna, again, gives you inspiration. When you talk about Krishna, he gives you inspiration. When you try to serve Krishna, he gives you inspiration. And when you're together with others, getting that inspiration, it becomes more inspiration. And that's also fun, because it's not, what was it? Krishna consciousness is against fun or something like that. What was it precisely, the wording? Anyway, we get together and we have fun, but this is fun, to think about Krishna, to chant Krishna's name, to think out different schemes and plans for spreading Krishna consciousness, to share the successes and the failures or the setbacks. That's all transcendental ecstasy. Is that okay? Okay, we did the topic. Now what are the questions? I saw some questions that were already there.
So, well, my volume.
Okay, well, we didn't get it, though. We just sent around a sheet of paper with some questions on, so I think we'll just tackle those questions first and then we can pass around the mic. Oh, there's more. Okay, excellent. Okay, okay, start with the first one. I don't control my senses. In Krishna's eyes, does my mentoring have any value?
I don't control my senses. Does my mentoring have any value?
In Krishna's eyes.
In Krishna's eyes. Well, of course you do control your senses. Otherwise you'd be, you know, an absolute wild person. You'd be Godzilla or something. You know, really. We all control our senses. It's just a question of to what extent or with what degree of success. So, of course, Krishna sees that this person's controlling the senses more, this person's controlling the senses less. First thing is to be serious about controlling our senses. If I'm not at least in the project of trying to control my senses, then I really wonder what kind of mentoring I'm doing, and Krishna might wonder also. You know, if I sit here and advise people how to be Krishna conscious, and then I go off and, you know, just pig out in sense grad land, you know, go out and have a few beers, and then, you know, what kind of mentoring is that? So it's assumed that we're all, in order to be a mentor, that at least we're in the project of controlling our senses. Now, sometimes I mean it doesn't mean that I'm a perfect, absolutely flawless yogi, that my senses never pull a fast one on me. But that my purpose is that I'm in the business of controlling my senses. I'm in the business of controlling my senses. Then it will be, and it's all right. Otherwise, it's hypocrisy that I'm advising you how to be engaged in Krishna consciousness, and then when I'm finished with that, I go off and do something absolutely opposite. So, to be a mentor, you shouldn't be Godzilla.
Okay, the next question. A mentor may comment on my personality that I believe is not true, but I trust their depth in spirituality to be able to facilitate my spiritual growth. Do I accept the feedback? Shall we do that again?
Okay. Okay, you can read it out again.
A mentor may comment on my personality that I believe is not true, but I trust their depth in spirituality to be able to facilitate my spiritual growth. Do I accept the feedback?
Yeah, do I? Good question. I suppose there's room for negotiation here. A mentor may comment, because personality assessment is not absolute. mentor may put forward something about my personality, and I may not think that that's true. And because the mentor is not omniscient, it may not be true. Or is not flawless, it may not be true. Or it may be true, but I don't understand how it's true. Or it may not be articulately expressed. It may be that he's seeing something about me and he says one thing, but it's not exactly right. But if you go about 15 degrees to the north, then it's right. Yeah, it's not exactly on target, but pretty close. So these things can be discussed. Of course, you may have the mentality that, well, he said it must be true. He said I'm, you know, whatever it is. A fussy little prig. So maybe I'm a fussy little prig, you know? I mean, a prig is an over-fastidious person. That's the definition. So I may be just one of those people who accepts it. You know, well, he said it, it must be true. Fine, you know. We usually benefit by accepting negative things about ourselves, unless we're in the philosophy that if you hear negative things about yourself and accept them, then your esteem goes down and down and down, and finally you end up being useless. But actually, to accept negative assessments is probably healthy, generally speaking, because we take it then, well, I'm deficient, I should build up. The other side is that there's room for negotiation. What do you mean? Doesn't seem that way to me. And then you explore the question. That's there. Mm. You know, it doesn't seem to me that I'm over fastidious. I thought I'm kind of over liberal. So what do you mean? And maybe, yeah, you arrive at some understanding that way. That's there. I trust their depth and spirituality. Also, just from another angle of vision, people who are deep in spirituality don't necessarily get everything right in terms of personality assessment, management, or any other department. A person may be very spiritually deep and, you know, whatever, think that you're managing the electronics right because he's got a misconception about electronics. Happens. So these things are all open. A mentee is not receptive to the input from a mentor. How long should a mentor sustain this relationship? Whoa. Interesting. Of course, you're asking for things that are not, these are not absolute questions. I can't quote you well. In the 8th chapter, Krishna says, you know, if a mentee is not accepting the feedback from a mentor, but that's a matter for your own consideration. You may say, well, this person is pretty far gone, but I'm going to try to help her. And, you know, even if it takes 3 years, you know, I see something in this person, and I see a little spark of sincerity, and even though she's, you know, so thick-headed that I can say something 43 times, and she still probably won't get it, but something might possibly... No. Still something must be getting through, and let me try. You may take it that way. Or you may take it that, you know, maybe I'm just the wrong person. You know, something about me, something about the chemistry, something about, well, you know, maybe I'm a good person and she's a good person, but she just doesn't really trust me or have faith in me, or I don't know what it is. So maybe I'm just the wrong person. Give her another, or maybe she'd get on better with somebody else. You can look at it that way. Try switching her off, giving her, or offering her another opportunity. You have that. Or, I suppose another opportunity is to say, listen, you know, we're not going anywhere. You know, I'm moving on to something else. It's up to you, you know. Go speak to whoever, you know, put you with me and say that I said you're a lost cause as far as I'm concerned, and, you know, if you have any insincerity left, then, you know. Otherwise, you know, you're kidding yourself. So, up to you, finally. As Krishna says in the 13th chapter, in the 19th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Okay. What have we got here?
What if you're guiding someone who just won't take up the process properly, but they still feel attracted to enough to stay in Krishna consciousness? What should I do if they constantly break the four eggs?
Somebody's... Let's see if I got that straight. We'll give you this a little bit. Okay. They're still attracted to stay enough. Well, Prabhupada had that problem, that he had people who were not following the process very well, but they had some sort of personal attraction to him. So that counts for something. That somebody's not very good at controlling the senses, somebody's very weak, but somehow or other that person is attracted to a devotee. But that's like a saving grace. Even now I can think of devotees who've had some sort of relationship with Krishna consciousness for many, many years, and still there's screwy things about them, and maybe they don't even follow very more than marginally. But somehow or other they have this attraction to Prabhupada. So that's like a special thing. Even though in terms of the process, they're not doing very well. But one very good thing, that they have this attraction to a pure devotee of Krishna. So something is there. Now we try to bring people into the process, obviously. We're feeling dissatisfied if they're not in the process or if they're messing up. So it is a question of our patience, tolerance. Prabhupada was quite, of course, not... There's this revisionist Prabhupada who just accepted everybody as they are and was unlimitedly compassionate and understanding and just, you know, just accepted everyone. And I never met that Prabhupada. you nonsense. What is the use of you? No, Prabhupada would be so cutting sometimes. But what is the use of you? You'll be intelligent in 5,000 years. You know, not just that, well, whatever you are, it's all right, I understand. Prabhupada could be very strong. Now, of course, he knew where to apply strength, when to be cutting, when to be gentle. Shruti Kirti Prabhu says that Prabhupada practically never scolded him because he knew that Shruti Kirti couldn't take it. But Prabhupada was like that some people he would be very strong with and some people he might be very indulgent with. Or, if not indulgent, anyway, not so critical. So everything is personal. Prabhupada was also a person. So again, it's up to you and your personal approach. A lot of these questions strike me as being within the realm of what's called professionally pastoral counseling, the art and science of advising people in their lives and their problems and their, you know, everything that's going on with them. That's called pastoral counseling, which is a lot of what, you know, priests and ministers and rabbis and so on are called upon to do. And there are books and courses and degrees and so on for getting into this. And it's not necessarily so that just because somebody's a good devotee, he's expert in these affairs. There is an expertise that can be cultivated. And yes, there is an expertise that can be cultivated, and there are people who have greater expertise than we do. Which doesn't mean run off to the psychology section of your local bookstore and check out all the books, but there are devotees also who have greater expertise in these things, including professional expertise. So we have a lot to learn. Not necessarily just because we've been a devotee for 2 years or 7 years. We're automatically expert in guiding people and the decisions in their lives. There's a lot to that. And I expect that as a society we'll develop greater expertise in these things. But a lot of it also, first of all, is your enthusiasm to help someone, your willingness to help someone, and your conviction that Krishna consciousness is the right medicine for whatever's wrong in our life. That is true, because there's a lot of people who are expert in all sorts of counseling, and other professional counselors, and they get paid big money, and they screw up people's lives big time, because they don't have any spiritual content. You know, at the end, the person is motivated and you know, feels wonderful about himself, and he's a jerk because he has no spiritual understanding. How do we know, how do you know, how to strike a balance between being strict on mentees without frying them out? Well, the way you know, actually, I'm sorry to say, is by trial and error. After you've fried out enough mentees, you start knowing a lot more about it. Try not to fry them out. On the other hand, a certain amount of strongness helps people. And if we're just always patting everyone on the back all the time, it gets yucky. And it doesn't do anything. So sometimes we need that. We need to be told, you know, what are you doing? You're wasting your time. You know, get it together. So again, it's a question of your experience, and it's a question also of consulting those who are more experienced. Therefore, I think it's the system in Chopati. I don't know if you have the same system, that the mentors meet together. Do you have that? That the mentors regularly meet together and they discuss these things. You know, I've got this person, I think I'm frying him out, but you know, if I don't say anything, then he doesn't go anywhere, and if I say something, then he starts to toast. So, what do you think I should do? And then they compare notes, and you know, you get a kind of combined expertise, the way doctors do. You know, they get together and they compare their. They do this. They regularly can talk about their cases. You know, I've got a guy over in this unit who's got this and this and this and this, and I've tried A, I've tried B, I've tried C. You know, what do you think I should do next? Get something.
Just related to that point, there's obviously some confidentiality things, so we can't discuss, I mean, so far we don't discuss people's personal issues with the rest of the mentors, because obviously it's still a small community, so how do we get through that?
That's a good question. Probably a question you could put to the people in Chopati who are doing it. If it's not such a situation where everybody knows everybody, you know, you can talk in the abstract, I've got XYZ kind of case, but if everybody's really close, they all know you're talking about, you know, Krishna Das. So then you have to consider. Except that one thing you can do is say, you know, would you mind if I talk about what we're doing with the other mentees? That, you know, we don't seem to be, you know, I have a question about what we're doing here, and do you mind if I discuss this with the other mentees? If the person says no, you've got a license. Is that okay? Yeah, you can ask those who are more experienced in the, which means basically the Jopati people, how they deal with that. Okay.
There's one more question.
One more question.
There's one more question here, and then we can go to the open part. Recently, I've been trying to chant with my eyes closed to concentrate more on the sound, but during chanting, I feel agitated, frustrated, and want to open my eyes. After finishing rounds, I feel like I've got a massive headache. Should I change my approach to chanting, or is this just because I've not yet developed a taste?
Recently, I've been trying to chant with my eyes closed to concentrate more on the sound. During chanting, I feel agitated and frustrated and want to open my eyes. Well, you can do that. That'll be good. Then you'll be agitated and frustrated and have your eyes open. Open or closed is not the issue. You may make a rule for yourself. Now I'm going to keep my eyes closed for this whole round or two rounds or whole 16 rounds. But there's not really a rule that you have to do that. The rule is to concentrate. So if you're concentrating with your eyes closed and then, you know, you're feeling, open them. Yeah. You might say, oh, open them and concentrate. There's no hard and fast rule about that, unless you make one for yourself. The point is not to develop expertise in keeping the eyes closed. Somehow or other to hear and chant. And that's Maya. You know, Maya gets, you know, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. And you feel like you're hearing it, and then Hare Krishna, I feel like opening my eyes, Krishna Krishna. Should I open them or shouldn't I open them? No, I should keep them closed a little longer. Rama, Rama. Yeah, that becomes all about our eyes and whether they're open or closed. Maya, she's so sharp, you know, she finds anything. Krishna, Krishna, Hari, Hari. I think I'm hearing nicely. Getting a little taste. Probably the other people aren't getting the same taste that I'm getting. Just, you know, she gets you from the right, she gets you from the left, or gets you from the front or the back. She's really subtle. You kind of get an appreciation how great Krishna is because his material energy is so impressive. After finishing rounds, I feel like I've got a massive headache. A little Darvan or something? I feel like I've got a massive headache. Should I change my approach to chanting? Well, if you didn't have such a massive headache when you had your eyes open, maybe there's something to be said for allowing your eyes to open under the circumstances. Save you on chemist bills. Mm-hmm. Is there? Yeah. Chant and be happy. Okay.
More questions have been passed forward to the front. So, what do you do when in your attempt to serve Krishna through what you're good at or enjoy, you get so involved that it becomes more important to me than Krishna conscious practices? What do you do when in your attempt to serve Krishna through what you're good at or enjoy, you get so involved that it becomes more important to me than Krishna conscious practices?
Good question. Yeah, we take on some service and we really like it. We're really having a good time. We're good at it. We're enjoying it. We get completely absorbed in it. That's good, actually. But it becomes more important than Krishna conscious practices. Interesting question. It shouldn't become so much more important than Krishna conscious practices that the practices that you go out of practice and you're so into your service that you stop chanting, you stop reading, you stop getting up in the morning and attending Mangalarti or whatever your sadhana is. It shouldn't be that happens, that you're so absorbed that your sadhana goes to hell. That's not good. On the other hand, to be enthusiastic about your service is nice. To be, you know, even that you look forward to, you know, completing your regular sadhana so that you can get into that service that you want to do. That is nice. Something that's very good. And you just may want to check in with yourself and see whether it's just that you just love, you know, working on your computer, or you just love whatever it is that you're doing, you know, sewing things and designing things or whatever it is, and you're just so into the thing that you forgot about the person that you're doing it for. You may just want to check in with yourself and remind yourself or ask yourself if you're just grooving on the thing itself and not on its relation, missing the relationship, because that's, you know, you don't want to miss the point. So it's worth reviewing. You know, we're always, the devotee is always in a sense self-critical. We're always looking at ourselves and saying, you know, am I Krishna conscious? Am I thinking of Krishna? Am I remembering Krishna? Am I following the orders of my spiritual master? Am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing? That's good. To be self-critical, to be self-analytical like that. As long as we don't drive ourselves nuts that way, it's good. It is good to be always self-critical. Otherwise, person who has no self-critical abilities, that's the person that we were talking about before. You know, you can't get through to them because there's no equipment, you know, the apparatus isn't there. It's not, they didn't install that module or something by which a person can look at himself and say, am I okay? Am I doing the right thing? Am I making sense here? They can look at the world and say, you know, that person is off base, that person is doing the wrong thing. But somehow the apparatus for self-criticism is defective or defunct. They can't look within themselves. So we need that. We need to be able to look at ourselves and say, you know, have I got it right, or am I doing it, or is there something I can do better? Or that's healthy. Even in the material world, you know, am I being attentive enough to my studies? Am I giving enough? Am I being decent with people I'm working with? If we don't have those self-critical abilities, then not so good. So to use that in relation to our service, am I missing Krishna because I'm so happy with whatever the material thing is? I love driving so much, and now that I'm driving for Krishna, I'm driving and driving and driving and driving and forgetting about what I'm driving for. No, that shouldn't be. And then you adjust. You say, well, I love driving, and I'm so happy that Krishna has given me this service, and I'm going to chant more while I'm driving, and, you know, find different ways to make sure that I'm always conscious of who I'm driving for. That's the practice, not to forget Krishna.
In relation to this relationship between service and chanting,
mm-hmm.
and practice, like if 99% of spiritual advancement is chanting, if 99% of spiritual advancement is chanting like that, then sometimes it feels like we're not putting 99% of our total effort into chanting, you know?
99% of our spiritual advancement is chanting. So it sometimes seems we're not putting enough effort into that.
Yeah, like proportionately, like.
Well, I haven't heard that statistic before, by the way. In fact, there are 9 methods of devotional service. Someone's more inspired by chanting, someone's more inspired by hearing, someone's more inspired by remembering, someone's more inspired by worshipping the deity. There are different ways that, you know, the proportions may differ. Chanting is certainly important and very central, because that's the instruction that Prabhupada gave to all of his initiated devotees. There's some quote of chanting that you should do. And the regular kirtan is important, so certainly without chanting, where are we? Some taste should be there for chanting. And the more taste, the better, and the more attention we can give to our chanting, the better. But again, some people, you know, their hook is the service. You know, some people, they're attracted to the Krishna consciousness movement. The chanting is so ecstatic. Some people, you know, they hardly get into the chanting, or other people, their philosophy is just so right on. Other people, they don't read the books, they're not into the philosophy, they don't chant, but they really, somebody asks them, you know, would you like to do something? You know, could you help us with XYZ? And the person just comes in on that vector, you know, that they just like to do service. So that is an asset also. Now, we know that if that person doesn't chant, then just writing in on service may not last. So we ask the person, you know, you're serving, and while you're serving, please chant, and so on. But part of the technique is to capitalize on what's working. You see a little spark, and you fan that spark. So if somebody doesn't have much attraction to chanting, but loves to serve, then what do? You encourage that person to go on serving. And here's some more service. And could you do this? And could you do that? And would you like to do this? And would you like to do that? And heap them up with service, because the service will be purifying. They're serving for Krishna. They're serving in the association of devotees. They're going to make spiritual advancement just by serving. So that will, then at a point will come, they'll think, well, you know, everybody around me is chanting.
Mm-hmm. So the aim of all other processes is to encourage the chanting, or not?
The aim of all other processes is to encourage the chanting. The aim of all the processes is to develop love for Krishna. Now, the prime means for doing that in the present age is by chanting. But it's not that, you know, we're not stereotypical, and it's not that exactly the same medical approach works for every patient. Chanting works for everyone, yes, but we have to see where there's a taste, and where that taste is there, we try to encourage it, and as that taste is growing, it should, the other things will also develop. Just if one part of a tree is maturing, the other parts of the tree will start to mature. So if a person comes in, you know, you see what door a person comes in, what direction a person is coming from, where a person is inspired.
Yeah.
I probably did that whole life membership program was for that. You know, these people were not, if you just said to them, now, here are your beads, and I want you to chant at least 5 rounds a day, or 6 rounds a day, or 2 rounds a day, these people would be, you know, just left out in the cold, because they're not going to chant. But so they're approached, could you, sir, you're very, you know, you're somebody in the world, and you're doing well in your business, and could you support this noble cause? And the person thinks, yeah, I could support this noble cause. And he gives something. So now he's connected by his service. Everybody's heart is in their pocket, so he's got some, feels that this money is worth something, I've worked for this, and now he's given it to Krishna. So now there's a relationship. He feels like he's a member of the society. He's even got a card that says he's a member of the society. Maybe he even goes to different temples because, you know, he saves on hotel bills or whatever reason it is. But there's, now he's come in from a certain direction. And the hope is that because now he's giving, so he may give more, he'll take some literature, he'll think, well, I'm a member of the society and they've sent me this literature, maybe I should look at it and see what it's about. Or he'll mix with the devotees and the devotees will tell them something about Krishna. Huh? So it's a kind of a flexible approach to cultivating, drawing out a person's Krishna consciousness. It's not just stereotypical that, you know, Krishna consciousness means chanting, and, you know, if you don't chant, how are you going to be Krishna conscious? So here, take these beads and chant. It's not only that. We have the beads and we do want people to chant, and we know that if they don't chant, they're not going to get this, they're missing a huge opportunity. But it's not the only game we know how to play. It's not the only approach that we have. We can approach them this way or that way or the other way. Jayananda Prabhu was known for that. He would, you know, get some guy off the street and say, you know, we need to do someone to do some hammering. Could you do some hammering for us? And the person's, you know, next thing he knows, he's building a Ratiyatra car. So that's part of the art, to find something that someone likes to do and engage that person in doing that thing for Krishna. And then, you know, let everything build.
How did Prabhupada maintain spiritual guidance when access to his guru was so limited, and more so once the guru departs? In the same light, that's the first part, and then there's another part.
Well, Prabhupada said the association was by sound. That actually, Prabhupada's physical association with his Guru Maharaj was very limited, and especially compared to his godbrothers, because the godbrother, Prabhupada was in householder life, that he had so many brahmachari sannyasi godbrothers. So they were always with Guru Maharaj, and Prabhupada was busy in his household affairs. So he got comparatively little association. But he received some instructions from his spiritual master, and he took those instructions very seriously. He kept those instructions within his heart and tried to execute those instructions also. So that's association by sound. The books were there also, as Guru Maharaj's books and so on. So he was reading that, the literature, and he was associating with other devotees who were trained in the philosophy and so on. So everything was there. So he was associating with devotees, he was reading the books, he'd received some instructions, and he took those instructions seriously. Some of my godbrothers also, they had very little association with Prabhupada. Some of them even no association with Prabhupada, physically speaking. So, you know, but that's not what it depends on. It doesn't depend on physical association. Physical association is an advantage. If you get that, it's not like nothing. It doesn't count. Even a moment's association can change your whole life. But absent physical association, there's association by sound, which is, in one sense, more valuable because it's never lost. Physical association is sometimes available, sometimes not. But association by sound is always there. Okay? Well, okay. Maybe.
The second part of that question is... What do you do when you can't fix your mind completely on Krishna whilst chanting, and your mind keeps thinking of other unnecessary things? Do you just keep trying until you feel it?
Yeah, that's stated by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Yato yato nischalati manas chanchalam asthiram tatas tato niyamyaitad atmanyeva pashamnaye. I think this is sort of drifted down a little bit, hasn't it? It could drift up anyway.
Prefer it like that?
No. Here. Let go.
Oh, sorry.
This is okay this way, but maybe this could be a little higher. Or is it okay? That's the one. Yeah. That's it. That's good. Tighten it up. That's better, yeah? Okay. Atmanyeva Vishamneya. Krishna says, wherever the mind goes, yato means like to any place, you know, wherever. It means it's going all over the place. Wherever the mind wanders, yato nischalati. Nischalati means wandering. Manas chanchala. Chanchala means fickle. And asthira means not steady, unsteady. Wherever the unsteady, fickle mind wanders around, tatastato, from this place and that place and whichever place it was, niyamyaitad. One has to bring it under control. Atmanyeva vasham. Atmani eva vasham. One has to bring it back into Krishna consciousness. Shanai upadamed. What is that? Bhagavad Gita. Shanai means slowly. Shanai upadamed. The sixth chapter. Shanai upadamed buddhya dritta grihitaya. Buddhya means intelligence. Dritta grihitaya, intelligence coupled with determination. Dritti grihitaya. Atma sangstam manakritva nakinchid apichintaya. One should fix the mind and not let the mind wander all over the place. That's the idea. Then prashanta manasadhyenam. Because you're training the mind in this way, the mind starts to become peaceful. I was listening to some seminars by Bhurishan Prabhu. He was talking about this. Something like training an animal. You know, you train the animal. The animal wants to go all over the place, a bull or whatever it is. Wants to go all over the place, and you let him know who's boss. And nope, you've got to get back in track. And he's back in track for a couple minutes, and then he's bolting off again. No, boom, you got to be back in track. After a while, the animal gives up. All right, I'm just in track. Okay, surrenders. I'm not going to get anywhere with this routine, so I might as well just do what I'm supposed to do. Or a child. The child gradually becomes trained. And, you know, I can't get away with this. I might as well just surrender. Then he becomes good, well-behaved. So the mind also, as it comes to understand that wherever I go, they're going to keep bringing me back. Wherever I go, he's going to keep bringing me back. I might as well just stay here. So the mind becomes prashanta. It starts to become peaceful. Yoginam sukham uttamam. And the devotee attains the highest happiness. Upaiti shanta rajasam. Shanta rajasa. This wandering is due to the mode of passion. You know, passion is agitating. Here, there. Shanta rajasa. The mode of passion starts to cool down. Mind becomes peaceful. And he becomes more Krishna conscious. Brahmabhuta kol nasham. So, and finally, basically, one becomes completely Krishna conscious. So, it's practice. This is the practice of chanting. We know that the mind is in the business of wandering. The mind is in the business of wandering. And the practice is to bring it back, and bring it back, and bring it back. And it's fortunate that we're not silent meditators, that we have this mantra to which we can bring the mind back again and again. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. So we know that we've failed so many times, that the mind has wandered so many times, but we're going to keep bringing it back. This is practice.
How can I persuade my dad for me to have a mentor without getting into an argument?
Gee, I don't know. This is a political question, of course. Family politics. What sort of objection would... I suppose to make not such a big thing of it, you know. It's not like I come home, Dad, I'm accepting a mentor. You're what? You are not. Well, it's not such a big thing. It's just taking some little advice here and there. Smaller a thing it is, the less there is to object to. That would be my first thought. Now, you know, without knowing the specifics of the battle. Is that okay?
Yeah. How? Oh, sorry.
I'm both a mentee and a mentor at the moment, and when I was a mentee, I always thought the emphasis should be more on the mentor to kind of facilitate, guide, and to make more effort in the relationship. But now as a mentor, it's like, it seems difficult sometimes. So I think, okay, is it up to the mentee to make the more effort, more kind of guidance, you know, ask for the guidance and be proactive? So is there a way that, you know, should it be the juniors guiding the seniors, or should it be that, sorry, the seniors guiding the juniors, or should it be that the juniors getting as much as they can from the seniors? Where does the kind of proactivity responsibility lie?
Where does the greater responsibility lie? With the mentor to, you know, kind of push the matter? Or with the mentee to push the matter? Well, it's a cooperative, it's a joint venture, isn't it? And I don't know of a formula that says, you know, the mentor should be 60% and the mentee should be 40%, or, you know, the other way around. But it's a cooperative project. Presumably, you want the mentee to make progress in Krishna consciousness, and the mentee wants to make progress in Krishna consciousness. So you both have the same goal. You're working together, and and a formula doesn't really need to apply. And sometimes they may be more enthusiastic. They may be pushing you on something. And saying, you know, what do I do about this, or what do I do about that? And on something else, you may be pushing them. What are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about that? Or sometimes you may not see a need for intervention, and they may not see a need for intervention. Things are moving along. There's, you know, not a whole lot of work that needs to be done this week. So, I don't know of, is that a good enough answer?
I was just thinking how it works with like the Prabhupada and the early days, and, you know, if the early disciples wanted something from Prabhupada, would they wait for him to give it, or would they just ask the questions?
With Prabhupada, how did it work? With Prabhupada, it worked differently for every person and differently for the same persons at different times. You know, sometimes Prabhupada, some people Prabhupada would always be pushing them. Sometimes people didn't hear from Prabhupada at all. You know, some people Prabhupada didn't directly push. Some people came forward more. Some people, different things. Even some people would render service in ways that other devotees didn't think about, you know, just personal things. Like I know some of my god brothers, like again, Bhushan Prabhu comes to mind. He just would regularly send some money to Prabhupada. You know, not necessarily a lot, but he would regularly send something. As a householder, he would send something. And other devotees, you know, they just never particularly thought. You know, they may have been doing so many other things, but they didn't, Prabhupada never asked, please send me some money regularly. They never thought I should do it. But he thought I should do that. So he took that initiative. Prabhupada didn't take the initiative, send me some money. Although sometimes with other devotees, you know, send me some money. You know, how much are you collecting? Why, you know, how much have you deposited? Please let me know. So sometimes Prabhupada would push, and sometimes it would come from the other side. Someone would, just on his own initiative, give something. So it was always, there was no rule. Always do it this way. I'll tell you one, though, that comes to my mind. Guru Kripa Prabhu told me this. He's told the story actually several times. How many of you know Guru Kripa Prabhu? One or two. Guru Kripa Prabhu is one of our extraordinary godbrothers. A huge proportion of the funding for the Krishna Balaram temple came from Guru Kripa Prabhu. Guru Kripa and a few other devotees. Yashodananda and Guru Kripa. They gave big collections to Prabhupada. And Guru Kripa Prabhu comes from the kind of background. He's a really hard guy. I mean, he's tough as nails. He is like, he's just a tough guy. He's a tough guy's tough guy. You know, it's like, out of the way, he's a tough guy. You know, just move out of the way when Guru Kripa's here because he's a tough guy. He's so tough. Really tough. And Prabhupada called for him in the middle of the night one time. Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. And Prabhupada called him. You know, he got this message, Prabhupada's calling for you. Got up out of bed, came downstairs. Prabhupada said, what were you doing? I was taking rest, Srila Prabhupada. Why you were taking rest? Well, Prabhupada, you know, I'm not a pure devotee like you. I need some rest. Why are you not a pure devotee? You know, and on it went like that. Whatever he said, you know. Finally, he reduced Guru Kripa Prabhu to tears. And, you know, no one but Prabhupada could reduce Guru Kripa Prabhu to tears, really. But Prabhupada, you know, he could be more tough than tough. Why you are not a pure devotee? You may not want to try that on your mentee. Okay, what else do we have cooking up here?
How long should I take to chant one round? If I'm taking less than 7 minutes, does it mean I'm not chanting properly?
There's no rule. You can be a 5-minute rounder or a 10-minute rounder. There's no rule at all. The rule is to try to hear yourself chant sincerely. You don't have to watch the clock. Some people are slower, some people are faster. If you find it's taking you half an hour to chant around, you may start wondering, you know, whether something needs attention here. But there is no rule about that.
Yeah. What takes priority? Staying up late to finish service, which means waking up late and falling behind in rounds, or waking up the next day, or chanting strong rounds early and perhaps not doing service till late. So it's a choice between late service and no rounds in the morning, or rounds and no late service.
Are you hanging out with UKLM? Is that what's going on?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I think we know them as the BMS,
right.
BMF,
Bhaktivedanta Matter Foundation. Yeah, this sounds like the perpetual BMF question. All the engagements are late.
Yeah.
You know, things get rolling about 9:30 in the evening.
If everyone's on time.
Yeah, if everyone's on time, it starts at 9:30 and it's over by. This is a problem. And it's after 35 years, and you know, it's still a problem. Ideally, we want to mold our life in such a way that we can get up early and chant. If you have late night engagements, you may want to see if you can sneak in some rest during the day. It's not against the rules to take some rest during the day if you can do that. When we were doing work producing books, sometimes we were working around the clock, and some people had the 12 to 4 shift. We used to do it like that. Someone was working 12 to 4, someone was working 4 to 8, and someone was working 8 to 12. And that meant AM and PM. So you'd work from midnight to 4 in the morning, and from noon to 4 in the afternoon. We had these machines that cost a lot of money in terms of what we had those days, and we were working machine around the clock. So that made pretty weird schedules for people, but they, you know, you get your rest. You adjust. Chanting is very important. Sadhana is very important. It's harder to chant later in the day than it is earlier in the morning. There's a special benefit to chanting early in the morning. On the other hand, you can't meet with the BMF people at reasonable hours because they don't have reasonable hours. You know, they're just not available. It doesn't work that way. I just came from the Gulf, and it's the same thing. In the Gulf, all the programs start, you know, 8:30 in the evening, 9 o'clock. And, you have to adjust. So, and it will be all, just take it as a given, it will always be a matter of an issue. It will always be an issue. It will always be something, right? Will be problematic when you have that kind of service. And you just always have to be aware of it and always have to try to guard your sadhana and not let it go to hell. Because it matters. Chanting matters. And it is possible when you have those kind of hours to just to let everything else deteriorate. So we should guard our sadhana. Yes.
Are there any other questions that haven't been passed forward, if there was any paper art or just general questions?
They're out of questions.
Yeah, there was one more on the paper. But
I just crumpled it up and it was... Sorry, I just crumpled you up.
Just remembered it.
Oh, yeah. Did Prabhupada explain your name giving? The name he gave to me? No?
Yeah.
No, he never said anything. When he gave me my name, he didn't say anything about it. Actually, I'll tell you the story.
Yes.
For my initiation, it was in 22nd Avenue. There were a batch of devotees sitting around. And Prabhupada handed me my beads and said, "Your name is Jairam." And my godbrother Jairam was sitting, you know, about this far. I didn't say anything, you know, now what do I do? Then one of my godbrothers, who was Prabhupada's secretary, he said, "No, Swamiji, there's already a Jairam." Oh, then Jayadvaita. So that's how I got my name. But one time, Prabhupada was touring the press when we were in Los Angeles. And my system of working was, I used to have a little desk about here, like that, with a typewriter or whatever. I used to sit on the floor with that desk, which is also how Prabhupada used to work. He used to have a little something. So when Prabhupada was touring the press, then he was coming to all the different rooms and seeing how the different devotees, what their service was, what they were doing. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj, who was with Prabhupada, said, "Jayadvaita likes to sit like this, just as you do." Prabhupada said, "Non-different." Jayadvaita means non-different. So Prabhupada said, "Non-different." So at least in that respect, I'm not different from Prabhupada. You know, we both sat on the floor.
So one little other thing. In regards to the topic today, that's spiritual guidance, is it possible if you could shed some light on a pastime of Prabhupada and one of your god brothers or yourself, where he guided an individual, one of his disciples, and how we might, well, for the mentors in here and for the future mentors, how they may be able to use that pastime or example in their dealings with their mentees and followers and whatnot.
Interesting. Of course, it was a little different because a disciple is a little different from a mentee. You know, you have greater authority when you're the spiritual master than when you're a mentor. Mentors can change, and you know, it's not that my only hope in Krishna consciousness is my mentor. So Prabhupada could get sometimes very demanding and strong from his disciples, which are, you know, stronger than you might want to be as a mentor. But let me think of some example where Prabhupada was very instructive. Prabhupada was so varied in how he dealt with devotees. Sometimes he would be, you know, very precise. This is what I want you to do, and this is how I want you to do it, and why are you not doing it, and I told you to do it, and what nonsense is this, and why you are doing it this way, I told you to do it that way. He could be very, you know, insistent. He could be cutting. He could be super sarcastic. You know, just rub it in and rub it in and rub it in. Oh, Prabhupada could be withering in with sarcasm. He could really be strong. Prabhupada could be very encouraging. Oh, you are so nice. Prabhupada could be silent. Same Guru Kripa, he told a story. He came to Prabhupada and from Vrindavan, he'd been collecting in Japan or someplace like that. He'd been, you know, from really, really working out and like just sacrificing and sacrificing. And he finally came to Vrindavan and gave Prabhupada an envelope with a check. And Prabhupada didn't even look at it. Didn't say anything. You know, you might have expected, oh, you're so nice, you brought this check. Whoa, $50,000 or whatever it was. Didn't say anything. Prabhupada had that prerogative, you know. He could be, you know, really take you by the hand and say how nicely it was you've done this little thing, or you could do something very substantial, and Prabhupada could, you know, that's all right. Put it on the desk. Prabhupada could be he's completely independent. He could do as he liked, but he had all sides to him. He could be, like they say about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, softer than a rose and stronger than a thunderbolt. Prabhupada could definitely give you the thunderbolt treatment, but Prabhupada could be so soft and so gentle. On one occasion, small thing, but we had one of my godbrothers is sort of very, I remember him as being very kind of always ready to make a speech. You know, he'd start to say something and he'd be ready to, you know, you'd expect that there'd be an elaboration and an explanation and sort of a, you know, dramatic delivery and so on. So this devotee, when at the end of a class, he said, Srila Prabhupada, we have a great desire to distribute your books. Prabhupada said, just keep that desire, that's all. The essential thing, too, you know, just keep that desire, that's all. One time, there was another devotee who was very argumentative, very difficult person to get along with. He was so difficult to get along, you know, it was always like, oh my goodness, he was so hard to get along with. And very strong sense of that he was right, and it got to the point where one incident I recall is that he was like fighting with Brahmananda, who was the temple president, and they were like, you know, on the floor, you know, it was like serious wrestling.
That's good.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't just, you know, a spectator sport. This was serious, like, you know, somebody could get killed here. It was really, you know, serious fighting. And Prabhupada, I guess Brahmananda wrote to Prabhupada in exasperation about this person. Prabhupada wrote back, he is a little eccentric, but he is coming from a good farm family. You know, Prabhupada would always, in that way also, Prabhupada would always, that somehow or other, whatever people are, they've come, oh, I remember a story. This happened to me. I was at an airport. Prabhupada was leaving, I think, from this airport. And we were all gathered around Prabhupada. Maybe it was LaGuardia Airport or JFK, New York, if I remember. Big crowd of devotees. And this one guy came, this one young fellow, who was a madman. He was, you know, by every kind of standard, you look at this guy and you say, whoa. He had some sign that he'd made that he was wearing around his neck that said something weird. You know, he was, whoa, this guy is from, you know, some other planet. And he just came forward all of a sudden and started pushing forward toward Prabhupada. And you know, I just kind of lunged for him, you know, this guy is just like, well, where is he going? But he just threw himself down in front of Prabhupada. And I was like, I'm going to haul this guy away or something. Prabhupada just, you know, gave him some mercy. Prabhupada was completely buried. That's the thing you could say. He could be you didn't know how he would respond in any occasion to anything. Whether he'd be appreciative or whether he'd say, you know. I remember one occasion, and I'm open to editing on this because I haven't compared my notes with the other people involved. But this is how my memory goes. We were in Boston, and the Boston Temple was set up in such a way that the temple was on the second floor. So you came up the stairs and there was a landing. The landing connected actually to a hallway which had led to adjoining rooms, or rooms adjoining the temple room on the second floor. So there was this landing, and then you went up a little more, you're in the temple room. So Prabhupada was there, he was coming up the stairs, so many devotees were there, and there was a young devotee, young lady, who just had a new baby. And so she sort of stationed herself on the landing. The Prabhupada will come up, he'll see the baby, and, you know, like that. So Prabhupada came up the stairs, she was there on the landing, and she, you know, had the baby there. Prabhupada saw the baby. Prabhupada said, so, your baby is nice? Or Krishna is nice? So, you know, you couldn't predict how Prabhupada would respond. You know, he could respond, we welcome this baby in Krishna consciousness. And, you know, so on some other occasion he might have responded then, but this is how I remember him responding on that occasion. Try trying to think of something that would really be pertinent to what you're asking about. In the beginning, Prabhupada was instructing about all sorts of things. You know, devotees would approach Prabhupada for with their medical problems, even, and Prabhupada was so kind, he would say, for this problem, you do this, for this problem, you do that, little home remedies and things like that. Later, of course, Prabhupada would, you know, so for this I have created the GBC. Kindly consult your local GBC man, who is such and such person, and basically leave me alone. I have so much, you know, 5,000 disciples, big piles of letters. And Prabhupada had things that he wanted to accomplish. So Prabhupada delegated so many things later. He only really, you know, it was understood that he only wanted to hear from his GBC men and you know, certain people, not that everybody should write him letters and this and that. But then again, there were devotees who, you know, without being GBC men and so on, they would write to Prabhupada and just, you know, had a sort of affectionate exchanges going on. They would send something to Prabhupada, especially. Somebody would send some fruits, or somebody would send some money or something regularly. And that way they had an affectionate exchange and cultivated that. I'm sorry, I don't have one. You know, one like this says it all kind of example.
Is it possible that story about when one devotee had a difficulty and the secretary publicized it? Prabhupada says, you know, confidentiality.
Oh yeah, of course that was there. That. Well, I can give two examples about that. This one is a fairly known example, the one that you mentioned, when Sannyasi had difficulty, fell into trouble. And it came to Prabhupada's attention, and it came to, I guess, Prabhupada, one of the secretaries, or someone who was in Prabhupada's entourage, or someone else anyway who was a big person. And they started, you know, publishing it, you know, telling everybody this is what's going on. I guess they sent a letter around or something saying this is what happened. And Prabhupada was so displeased. He said now he can never come back. He was so displeased. And, you know, Prabhupada wouldn't have dealt with it that way. And, you know, all right, you're having some problem, and, you know, not to publish it to the world. Very displeased. So you can extrapolate from that how Prabhupada might feel about what goes on the internet these days. You know, people feel that it's like their prime duty to get on the internet, and if somebody, you know, is seen chewing his fingernail, then everybody should know about it. It's just so anti-Vaishnava as a way of behaving. You know, if somebody has a problem, publish it. That's not, you know, a Vaishnava impulse. Did you hear about this person? Did you hear about that person? Did you hear about this person, that person? And then, you know, publish it in the newspaper. That's so contrary to our culture. It really is. A great person finds a small virtue in someone and magnifies it. And a small person finds a small fault in someone and magnifies it. That's the difference. So Vaishnava looks for somebody, you know, as a mentor, you look for somebody's good quality. You find out something about that person that's nice. This person's not very smart, but he's enthusiastic. This person's not very enthusiastic, but he's so intelligent. This person doesn't like to chant, but he loves to serve. This person doesn't like to chant, doesn't like to serve, but he's really a devotee of prasadam. This person, you know, whatever it is, find something. And then you magnify that. That was actually, Prabhupada gave that instruction one time about how to preach to people. So you find some quality, some something, a little spark, and you fan that. Look for that, and you fan that. There's something good about that person that you can you know, tie a rope to and start pulling toward Krishna. And that's the quality of a great soul, that he sees a little something and magnifies it. And the small-minded person, that's his quality, that he's just, Prabhupada said, the bees look for nectar and the flies look for pus. So we should be like the bees, looking for nectar. The other example that comes to mind is there was an incident, it's also rather famous, one of our leaders got involved with a woman, he was a sannyasi, got involved with a woman who falsely presented herself as a huge heiress to an automotive fortune. And he was cultivating this woman with the idea of getting her fortune to use in Krishna's service. And catching the fish, he could fill in the ocean. So, and he was the head of our New York temple, he was the GBC man there. So, and it was becoming a big scandal because this woman was being, you know, catered to and indulged, and he was meeting with her privately, and devotees were being told to do all sorts of things for her, and you know, it was just becoming bigger and bigger and bigger in terms of, it was becoming intolerable. Devotees were leaving, it was just a huge thing. And Prabhupada did not say a word about it. He didn't say anything. He heard about it, he collected the information, he sent someone there to find out what was going on, to assess the situation, but he didn't, you know, he was so cool. He was just so patient with it. Didn't blast this person, didn't, you know, start issuing off instructions, so remove this person and you take over and remove his signatures from all your bank accounts and boom, 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 boom. Prabhupada was very, didn't take action. Then later he came, and practically the whole time he spoke some very strong things, but they were in such an indirect way that people were scratching their heads wondering what he was exactly talking about. And he was just working patiently, trying to see how this person could be corrected. And finally the whole thing came out sort of its own accord. And even then Prabhupada didn't, you know, smash this person and publicize what a fool and a rascal he was. And even after this happened, in fact, Prabhupada himself performed the marriage ceremony of this person and that bogus heiress. And, you know, just seeing if he could hold on to this person and not lose his service. And later that he drifted away and so many things. And then Prabhupada's, he appeared in some other context, probably immediately gave him some responsibility in some other place, tried to engage him. So Prabhupada could be like that, just sort of like a doctor who doesn't, you know, lance a boil as soon as it appears, but waits for to see what happens and intervenes at the appropriate time, and doesn't, as in Prabhupada's words, use a cannon to kill a mosquito. You know, he knows how much force to apply, at what time, he knows how to be patient, how to wait. And above all, he's concerned about the welfare of the person. It's not, you know, we see something wrong and we're campaigning for truth, justice, and righteousness, but really what we're campaigning for is, I am campaigning for truth, justice, and righteousness. You know, it's our false ego finding a way to, you know, get out from under and reassert itself. It's all about me again. And it's not really about what's right or true or just. So Prabhupada was pure. So he was... although he had to balance, you know, the concern for the society, for the, you know, for the welfare of everyone. And I could tell another story where Prabhupada was not unlimitedly
the Prabhupada was very sharp with someone and practically cut him off. That's another story. But Prabhupada was always concerned for the welfare of everyone. It wasn't, you know, to assert his feelings, although he had feelings and he could assert them, but he was always concerned about the spiritual welfare of everyone. Somehow we have to develop that purity that we're always thinking about leaving the good of others.
And is Prabhupada still involved with the movement even now? Did he say that he would give us guidance in some sort of way? I mean, other than through his books, maybe even directly, like coming to people's dreams or look over it in some sort of way?
I never heard Prabhupada say anything about I will come to you in your dreams. Prabhupada emphasized, and you know, we've had that. We've had people, you know, who, of course, people have dreams about Prabhupada, and they have value. You can't, and in our sampradaya, there are so many things that happen from dreams. In reading Chaitanya Charitamrita, there are these significant dreams. So I don't want to dismiss dreams. But dreams may or may not be reliable. You know, probably may come to you in a dream and recommend a certain brand of cigarette, you know. It's you know, so dreams, but what Prabhupada spoke about was the instruction. And I'm there in the instruction. One time, Chaturani went to Prabhupada and asked, are you present in your picture? Prabhupada said, if by seeing the picture you remember the instructions, then I am present. If by seeing my picture you remember my instructions, then I am present. And that's where Prabhupada really put the emphasis. My dreams may or may not be reliable. The automatic writing that I do when I'm in trance thinking of Prabhupada, that may or may not be reliable. But the instructions that Prabhupada has given, especially in his books or in his lectures and so on, that's the real thing. That's the standard. So that we should, and Prabhupada's there, he's accessible. It's not that, and as we've heard so many times, it's not that he dies, that the Vaishnava dies. He lives on in his instructions. So this whole Krishna consciousness movement is, and one time Prabhupada said, the devotees in Boston on the occasion of, I think it was the appearance day of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, maybe this was 1969, something like that, we all got together and we all wrote little Vyas Puja offerings for Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And Prabhupada appreciated that, and he commented, I think it was on that occasion, or else I may be confusing it, it may have been on a different occasion. Anyway, Prabhupada said, the grandfather is more merciful than the father. So he affirmed that you're also getting the mercy of my Guru Maharaj through the parampara system. So Prabhupada is always there in his instructions and accessible for everyone. Prabhupada's all over ISKCON. He's there in his books, he's there in his temples, he's there in his deities, he's there in his devotees. Is there in our system of doing things? It's, you know, it's like everywhere in the company. And his presence is felt throughout the Krishna consciousness movement. So we're all going on by Prabhupada's mercy. Stop here.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah, it's okay with me.
His Holiness Jayavet Swami Ki
Jai,
Srila Prabhupada Ki
Jai,
Pandavasena Ki
Jai,
Gaura Premanande
Haribo.
Wow. Just like to thank His Holiness Jayavet Swami again because
it's past my bedtime, right?
Stole my line. because I mean that ended on a truly beautiful note, and just thank you for kind of taking us back so that we could see how Prabhupada was and how Prabhupada is, just so that we can feel him here with us, because we'd all like to. So yeah, just thank you very much for...
Well, thank you very much. You all remember Prabhupada.